Nice to be serenaded by the birds. So it's been an interesting day, the unusual for the way I normally lead these retreats, in that they're pretty much always outside, and so this was an interesting exploration, going the movement inward, inside outside, and just seeing the how that influences our mind and our body and our consciousness and heart and presence. I trust that was an interesting dialectic for you, just exploring the different facets of that movement, you know, and the different qualities that come, different energy that comes, different interest, different stimuli. So the challenge for me whenever I move outside, even though I'm looking at the building, I don't feel like I'm quite outside, but sort of, is my mind gets really quiet really quickly. And I don't have anything to say. Which is a bit problematic when you have to give a talk and you have to kind of be coherent. And I don't know if you find that, but when I come outside, I just get very quiet. It's just very easy. It's not a struggle. It's not like, you know, it's not work. It's just, you know, just quietens down. The influence of the natural world and the quality of energy and presence that touches my being, my nervous system. It's almost like, I'm not, but it's almost like I'm holding my breath, like talking in a hushed way to not miss anything, like to be sensitive and attuned to the sweetness and the delight. And it's such a delight that there's more competing for our attention than our thoughts, than our busy mind, right? It's not that the busy mind goes away when we come outside, but there's a lot more to rest the attention. A lot more interesting things, to be honest. Occasionally our mind's interesting, but not so much, really. So I always start my nature retreats with this prayer from the Ute peoples. I haven't read it because I haven't been outside, and I always want to read it outside, especially since they walk this land. And it's a beautiful prayer or a invocation to nature and the perennial ways that it can teach us. And I first heard it when I was in a ceremony walking to the Buddha tree, and one of the founders read this prayer, and I was very touched. It goes like this: Earth, teach me stillness as grasses are stilled with light. Earth, teach me suffering as old stones suffer with memory. Earth, teach me humility as blossoms are humble with beginning. Earth, teach me courage as the tree which stands all alone. Earth, teach me limitation as the ant which crawls on the ground. Earth, teach me freedom as the eagle which soars in the sky. Earth, teach me caring as the mother who tends to her young. Earth, teach me to surrender as trees shed their leaves and fall. Earth, teach me regeneration as the seed which rises in spring. Earth, teach me to remember kindness as rain drenches dry fields. And Earth, teach me to forget myself as melted snow forgets its life. So you can feel in that prayer this exquisite attunement to the natural world as a teacher. It's so many ways that nature teaches. The question is, there's a big if. Right? The if is if we are present, and if we approach and enter and immerse in nature with a quality of attunement, of reverence, of respect, of appreciation. You know, many of the qualities that we develop through this practice of mindful awareness develops that sensitivity, that receptivity. So we can be touched in many of the ways that that prayer is speaking. Maybe today already you've been touched by many things, by, you know, joy. Earth, teach me joy as the aspen leaves shimmer in the breeze. Or Earth, teach me melting as rain drenches into the forest. In many ways that we move, touched, inspired. Nature's offers a perennial metaphor, reflection for life, for truth, for reality, for our experience. So when I was writing the book, Awaken the Wild, I was very struck by what was coming forth in the writing, which was this interplay between mindful awareness and nature, and this lovely reciprocal dance that as we cultivate awareness, mindfulness, sensory awareness, that sensitivity attunes us, opens us, allows a deeper connection with the natural world. And at the same time as we do that, the natural world is constantly alluring our attention. Okay? Just now, like the light, and then the clouds, the trees, the grasses, the fluctuation of song, the quality of the air that's always shifting, the life on the ground, the critters. So it's easy, in a way, to be present. Easier, I would say. Not easy, but easier. There's still plenty that takes us away, right? And I've been struck by that over the years, leading these, doing my own retreats and then leading these retreats, how this quality of allurement, how nature allures attention. Right? Like if we said, you know, take a walk and be present, you don't have to try that hard. You walk and you're looking at the grasses and you pause and you hear the song and you step into the forest and the smells light up your nose, and right, it's not difficult. It's not difficult to abide here. And so the qualities that support mindfulness, like receptivity, listening, slowing down, curiosity, attunement, and they somewhat naturally come forth. So one of the things I stress on these nature retreats is, as we spend more time outside, which we will from henceforth, is to relax into that, the naturalness of awareness, the naturalness of our attention being called. So a practice that I like to teach, it's kind of a playful practice. We'll do it now just for a minute, just for the fun of it. So it's a practice called, I haven't really given it a name, but I should. It's what's really unmindfulness. So we're going to practice unmindfulness for a minute, which means I don't want you to pay attention. I don't want you to be aware. I don't want you to notice anything. I don't want you to make any effort, and see what happens. Off you go. No noticing anything. Okay, how'd you get on? Did anybody succeed in not being aware? What did you notice? Anyone?
Birds.
Pardon?
Birds.
Birds, you notice hearing. So you notice seeing visual stuff, trees.
The attention always wants to be somewhere.
The attention always wants to be somewhere, right? It's always attending to something.
Discomfort in my body with the directions.
Notice discomfort in your body. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Heightened awareness.
Heightened awareness.
Yeah.
Right. Most people report that's the most mindful part of the retreat. Right. Suddenly everything you just notice, wow, I'm not, you know, awareness is just here, doing itself, without me getting in the way, trying to be mindful, trying to meditate, trying to pay attention. So, oh, if I just relax, it's happening by itself to a certain degree. So if the essence of what mindfulness is awareness, and awareness is always here, aware of something, then what's the problem? Why do we spend so much time trying to be mindful if awareness is always here, noticing something? This is a really good question. Why do we try so hard? So, if awareness is always aware of something, then the important question is, what are we aware of? What are we attending to? So to some degree, I'm not sure if this is true. So what are we paying attention to? What takes our attention? What are we directing our attention to? Or what is the attention naturally being pulled to that we're either mindful or unmindful of?
When you're not being mindful, you're ruminating.
Right. Yes. No, exactly. Right. We go in what neuroscience calls the default mode network. We go into rumination, worry, plan, self story, narrative, and worse. You know, anxiety, catastrophe, all the dramas of the self. So,
The hook. We get hooked.
Right. And but mostly it's to our mind, right? Which is mostly not in the present. So we want to notice, I mean, that's really where much of the work is with mindfulness practice, is, as we've seen sitting in there, is unhooking that tendency to be lost in thought.
I think it's and quite difficult because you're in the dark, your eyes are closed.
Right, so we're accentuating that.
It turns.
Right. Right, we're accentuating to some degree that habit because there's nothing much to call the attention. Right? So why one of the reasons why nature practice can be supportive is because it's easier for the mind, the awareness, to rest in the present because of the various stimuli. Right? And there's an art to how to use that awareness and use that stimuli. And sometimes it feels like cheating. It's like, you know, you come outside, maybe we'll sit out here and we'll do a listening meditation. And it feels pretty easy. Sounds, birds, breeze, whatever. But of course, at some point, our mind, given its default mode, will do out here what it does in there, which is, well, that's all very nice, bird song, but I want to know when I'm going to get my next promotion. And, you know, chocolate cake or whatever, you know, shiny thing I'm thinking about, right? So, you know, the same habits happen out here, just there's a little more competition for the thinking, which is a nice support for practice.
Is the default mode learned? Or is it?
It's part of the sort of the brain's makeup.
Children don't have it yet.
Right. When we're young, we don't have our cognitive structures so developed. But at a certain point, I don't know the etymology of when it. But it's not. It's one way of understanding the way our mind ruminates. So. Yeah. We just like we're hardwired to the negativity bias. Yeah, because of our evolutionary. Well, that's why meditation is hard, because we're working with circuitry that was, you know, developed over millions of years, oriented towards survival, safety, awareness of threat. Seeking for comfort, security. Right? So that's the training. That's the practice. That's the discipline part. And that's why we have to have compassion, because it's not like we want to be, you know, designing our, you know, forest cabin every meditation for the next 7 days. But, you know, that's where we go. We go to, you know, either shiny object or survival, fear, you know. And so that's why we need to be kind with our wandering, distracted mind, because it's not our fault. Right? It's just what happens. I was going to call my inner critic book, "It's Not Your Fault." I borrowed that line from Wes Nisker, who talks a lot about evolutionary biology as a doorway for compassion, self-compassion. And he said, no, you can't use that because I'm going to use it for my next book. So anyhow, but it's not our fault. It's really useful to remember when your mind's just dragging you around that, you know, that's the dukkha, that's the suffering of our biology, you know, of our hardwiring. That's why we train, that's why we practice, that's why this fusion of meditation practice in nature, I think, is a beautiful combination. Just as the Buddha practiced in the forest and millions of people have in the mountains and the caves and the deserts and the forests, because it's a support. It's a support to help with that challenging mind. And why not practice in conducive conditions? Just as, you know, most retreat centers are built in quiet places to be conducive, in the same way that they're built in nature, in beautiful nature spots, to be conducive. Something about nature that settles the mind. There's a lot of interesting research happening right now around the impact of nature on our physiology, on our well-being, you know, the research just validates our own empirical experience, which is nature's good for you. Duh. It's soothing to the nervous system. It allows the mind to calm down. It reduces rumination. Some researchers call the Kaplans, a couple, they have this phrase, it's a beautiful phrase, so I think it's really apropos for the work we're doing. They say what happens, and there's a whole field of study of nature and people in nature called nature restoration therapy, that for when we're in nature, it's restorative for the brain because this is where we evolved. Yeah. You know, if you're downtown San Francisco, the brain's working overtime, you know, given the trillions of data points that come in every moment to try and assess, is that a bus? Is that a moving object? Is it going to hit me? You know, are these people, you know, safe? There's just a lot of stimuli that's challenging for the brain. That's why we get tired. We come out into nature, for most people, not everyone, it's restorative because the brain actually has to work much less hard. It's very interesting. So they talked about the quality that arises for people somewhat naturally, but what we're developing consciously is this quality they call soft, it's quality of attention called soft fascination. Soft fascination, which I think is a beautiful description of really what we're doing here. As you walk mindfully down to the river and just being present in a relaxed way to your environment, I imagine that you're mostly in this quality of soft fascination, right? Where you're just intrigued and enjoying and being allured and fascinated by the beauty and the complexity and the diversity and the richness and the colors and the light. And so, you know, there's a whole bunch of great research happening in South Korea and Japan particularly. They're doing a lot of work around forest bathing, which is another phrase I also love. People go, I mean, it's basically walking in the forest, but with some quality of attention, and being bathed by the forest. It's such a, you know, we're being bathed by the mountain here, you know, bathing, nature bathing. It's a beautiful frame, right? So much of our language, which is dualistic, entails doing something, right? You know, and then I heard this expression a lot when I came to America, like, yeah, I did Europe in 3 weeks. Like, what exactly did you do to Europe in 3 weeks? You know, I did that mountain, like, in my best time. Like, well, how do you do a mountain? Like, you know, one can be on the mountain, you know, and be with, you know. So, you know, we're biking, hiking, conquering, doing something, which is fine. But we miss so much other receptive qualities that really are some of the fabric of this, the orientation of this practice. So one of the things that arises that I'm sure you've already been feeling, maybe from the moment you got out of the shuttle or your car and just walked on the land a little, or but certainly after being here for 24 hours, is just feeling a sense of ease or peace. Right? The nervous system starts to slow down its revving. Mind slows down its busyness. And we come into, you know, the peace of nature that's not stressing and angsting in the same way that Homo sapiens do. And it rubs off on us. We feel it. Something wakes up, I think, in our biology of like, oh, right. We know this. Right? We were hunter-gatherers for hundreds of thousands of years. And only the last 10,000 years that we've left to a large degree that landscape. So something I know for myself exhales. And especially the wilder the place, the deeper the exhale, the deeper the resonance. So there's a poem, some of you will know this poem from Wendell Berry, and I think he speaks to it beautifully. As you can see, I like to read a fair amount of poetry because poetry speaks the language of nature in a way, which is not so linear. And he says, and I think this is a very common experience for many of us, waking up in the night, he says, when I wake up in the night, at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may become, I go outside and go lie down where the wood drake rests his quiet beauty on the water and where the great heron feeds. I come into the presence of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of day-blind stars waiting with their light. And I forget how it goes. And for time I rest in the grace of the world and am free. So he goes outside to lie down, come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives in the default mode network with worry and fear about his life and his children's lives and whatever else we're worrying about. Right? The trees, the aspens, aren't worrying about the next rainfall. Well, maybe they are, but I don't think so. They respond, but I'm not sure if they're angsting. So... you know, so it's important that we come to these places to let that rub off on us. Right? We're very influenced. The Buddha was very clear. Be mindful of, you know, what company you keep. Be mindful of the places you put yourself in. And he said, if there's nobody, you know, around you that will support a wholesome state of mind and heart, he said, be alone. And I think it's, you know, same advice with, you know, go to the forest if that's supportive of your well-being. You know, to the end of many of his teachings, he would say, you know, you've heard the teachings, basically get on with it. There are trees and there are the roots of trees. Go meditate there lest ye regret it later. There are trees and there are the roots of trees. Go meditate there, lest you regret it later. So, you know, encourage people a lot to sit in the forest. not in a city, not in a house, and to have that influence, mind, heart, body. So in this talk, I'm just sort of sharing different things of why we're doing this practice outdoors. You know, what's sad, I just read an article, I might have mentioned about that 90% indoors. Children, this generation of children spend 50% less time outdoors than the previous generation. But I imagine the previous generation probably also spent 50% less time than, you know, when many of you and I were kids. I had the luxury of having, we were pretty poor growing up, and both my parents worked, and I lived close to the farms and the ocean, and we just got kicked out and, like, you know, go play all day, and, you know, and that was growing up, was just going outside and causing trouble in, you know, in the woods and the farmers' fields, and little pyromania was kind of part of that. That's, you know. But that doesn't happen so much, right? Kids, you know, kids' time's structured. It's a lot of screen time, and there's a lot of fear about safety. And so there's just, you know, it's a tremendous tragedy that children have so much less access to just wandering around. I was teaching in a tech company last week in the city in San Francisco, I was being introduced, and it was a post-talk reflection, and she said, and I was talking about nature, and she said, I feel really sad for my kids. She had teenage kids, and she said, when I was a kid, we used to just, did I say this already? Maybe I did. We just used to look around and stare at things. We used to, like, go in the garden and just kind of look around, look at the tree and look at the sky and fiddle with bugs and just look at things. And it really struck me like an arrow in my heart. It's like, ooh, like how painful. Like kids, especially teens, don't look at things except screens for the most part, you know. And, you know, like how much time, like in you, if you reflect on your own childhood, you just lie, and like I used to lie, we used to make these tunnels out into the middle of wheat fields and just lie on our backs for hours, just watching the wheat sway and then the bugs fly in the clouds. And it's just, you know, idle and blessed. So what a loss. So another thing that coming outdoors does is it gives us a sense of perspective, right? And maybe you saw that moving indoor outdoor, right? And especially in the lives that we live in, you know, confined spaces, right? Homes, offices, cars, cubicles, right? and we get so myopically self-absorbed because that's the sort of world we're bouncing around like a pinball. And we step outside, we go for a walk around our office block, or we go for a walk around our neighborhood, or we step into our backyard, and suddenly that self-referencing starts to soften a little. It's like, oh, wow, it's a beautiful summer's day. Oh, it's been raining. Oh, wow. Look, I can see the geese migrating, or the blackbirds have returned. And it just takes us, you know, just gives us a vantage point which we're often suffocating for. So, and is it what I appreciate about nature? There's a lot of really interesting juxtapositions. So one of those two I want to talk about. One of those is silence. Right? As we can hear, it's not silent. It's rarely silent. Right? Nature's loud, busy, you know, birds, frogs, crickets, wind, coyotes, you know, all kinds of things. But within that, there's a silence. Like, I particularly feel this at night. I was teaching, as I mentioned, in Massachusetts, IMS, Insight Meditation Society, and there's this beautiful chorus of frog song in the evening. And it's quite deafening sometimes. But also there's a profound silence in it. And it's very mysterious. I remember being in Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha attained awakening, and again, the crickets are very loud. And yet there's a stillness and silence within the sound that we can attune to. Easier than finding the silence in traffic or in your neighbor's, you know, boombox or whatever. And the same with stillness, right? Sometimes it's still, like the aspens are still right now. The light can be very stilling, the grasses. But often there's a lot of movement, dynamism, flux, cloud, wind, birds. And yet there's a stillness in that we can access. That, you know, as I said, because we're so influenceable, sort of is a better word than that, then it rubs off, you know, that we start to feel that stillness within. Anybody feel more still today than yesterday? A little more calm, a little more. We stand by a tree. Hopefully some of you are doing a standing meditation by a tree and just feeling the stillness, you know, these old trees or even young trees. It's a beautiful teaching from Achan Cha, and he's talking about the variability of practice. And he says, so too your practice will not all be identical. Don't think or worry about this. Try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become quieter and quieter in any surroundings. It will become like a clear forest pool. Then all kinds of wonderful and rare animals will come to drink at the pool. You will see clearly the nature of all things. You will see many wonderful, strange things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha. So there's a lot to be understood in stillness and what stillness really is, particularly in the depth of stillness, right? And stillness, support for samadhi, this gathered, collected attention. That's why we orient to stillness with our posture. I also love nature practice and retreats because it keeps you on your toes. Like, you never know what's going to happen. Yeah, I planned this whole day meditating up the hill, then we were going to meditate over there, and then walk down the river, and then, well, good luck. You know, there's a certain fluidity that has to happen, certain responsiveness. And as much as we might enjoy nature, there's plenty of stuff we don't like. Right? Cold, bugs. Maybe some of you don't like wind, lightning, darkness, nighttime, predator animals. There's many things that might be scary or unsettling. Or unpleasant. Definitely done lots of retreats where the unexpected happened, and you know, we were meditating up on that where we'll be tomorrow, and in the morning it's crystal clear, beautiful blue sky, but the clouds come very quickly here, the storms come very quickly here, and so the storm started moving in. It's like, oh, okay, and I was meditating, kept looking up, and like, I think we'll make it to lunch, you know, meditating. And all of a sudden, there's a massive hailstorm comes. And like about an inch of hailstorms in like 10 minutes. And you're all scrambling down the hill. Excuse me, if you can get Joanna, you leave that stuff till there's time for that. So come listen to the talk. Joanna, come listen to the talk. Dinner will be a little late, so okay, come listen. Come listen to the talk. You know, but that's happened so many times. And it's a great place to practice. You know, how do you deal when you don't like what's happening? Like maybe you're cold right now and you're a little grumpy that it's cold. Oh well. How do we practice with adversity, right? Which is like life. You know, I love nature for that. It pushes us. Okay? We might be really enjoying the morning sunlight because maybe we had a cold night in our tent and we're sitting just delighting in the sun. But that's only the first few minutes of the meditation. And the meditation's 45 minutes and you start burning up in the sun. And you start hating the sun and resenting it and wondering why we're not in the shade. And then the clouds come over and there's, oh, thank you, clouds, may be happy. And then we start getting chilled. And then we're wanting the sun back. That's life. And for many years, afraid of the dark and afraid of being out in nature at night. And which is a problem when you're camping alone in the wilderness. you get to work with your stuff. And one of the first times I camped up here, as I said, I came up when this first opened, there was only like, I don't know, half a dozen retreats a year. So there's a lot of space, and I was nomadic, so I just stayed here between retreats. And there was a period, it was a long gap, at least a week. And I was camping out over there, and I was terrified. Every noise was a bear waiting to chew my head off, and the cougar was stalking, and the coyotes were ganging up, and you know. It's great fear practice. And how do you find steadiness and presence and calm in the face of fear? And there's a funny story, I write about it in the book, where I was in one of these canvas tents, and we have this weird illusion that, well, I'm in my tent, I'm safe. You know, bears can't get me through this tiny little nylon thin layer, like, oh, I'm safe, you know. As long as I don't go out there, I'm not going to pee, I'm just going to stay in my tent till dawn. And I realized it was, and every noise was like, oh, maybe that was the thing. And I just got paranoid. So I decided, you know, I had this fear of what was outside the tent. So I moved my bed outside the tent. I just put my bed in the middle of the meadow. So I wasn't caught in this trap of indoor, outdoor, me, them. And it really helped relieve a lot of anxiety. It was just like, you know, I could look around. It's like, oh yeah, and there's no bed just about, you know, it's waiting for you to pee. So what else? So as I said yesterday, one of the beautiful things about this work and being in places like this is how it opens the heart. It's hard for the heart to stay closed here. You know, something will touch it, will move you, will pierce your heart, will resonate in some way. I stay up in the middle house, the house up the road on the right, and last year we had a wren's nest right in the aspens, and just would watch the parents feed the young, and the young were teeny, 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 shivering, shaking, and thinking I was mama ran and sorry. And just the sweet joy that would just come from seeing just that the tenderness and the fragility and but the 100 ways, 100,000 ways that our heart can be touched with joy. And I really want to invite you to orient towards that which is uplifting. You know, the Buddha talked about inclining the mind and heart in ways that are supportive for our well-being. So when you're caught up in your own narrative, you may be going for a walk and you're lost in thoughts, and stop. Shift your attention. Notice what's around you. Notice what touches your heart, what brings joy. And let it, and savor it. You know, there's the research about letting the, when we feel joy or touched by joy, let it in for about 20 seconds. Like really let it saturate your being, or longer than that, 20 minutes. So there's a poem that I love to share from Mary Oliver called Mindful. And if I only have one poem to share with people about nature, I share this one because it's such a great poem. And she says, every day I see or hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It is what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world with joy and acclamation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, but of the common daily presentations. Oh, good scholar, I say to myself, how could you help but grow wise with but teachings as these? The untrimmable light of the world, the oceans shine, and the prayers that are made out of grasses. So every day, probably every hour here, we see or hear something that more or less kills us with delight. So let it wash over you, let it wash into you. And in that, when we're touched in that way, you know, it opens up the doorway to a deeper intimacy or opening, where maybe that opens into awe, or as you pronounce it, ah, ah. Sounds like it has an R in it. R, oh. Anyhow, you know, to let yourself be awe-filled, awe-filled. And that can open us into wonder, you know, into the mystery, into the sacred. Right? We get touched by so many things, the silence, the light, the stillness. And we intimate, we sense something vast, something profound, something beautiful, something mysterious, something sacred. And we have no words for it. In those moments of being touched in that way, they're beyond the mind, they're beyond words. And we feel something profound, and we may feel a sense of reverence or humility, and we well up with tears or everything drops away. And all that's left is the sound of aspen leaves rustling. And we might try, after that experience happens, which was what we do to make sense of our experience, you know, we try to put it into words. Insight, I'll talk more about that tomorrow, the next day, you know, is wordless. And the mind makes sense of it through words. In the same way that these profound mystical moments that we can have outdoors, wordless. And then we make sense of them through words, through meaning, through sharing them. But they never come close to that lived, visceral, you know, awakening moment. And as we do this practice more and more, and learn, you know, train the mind so it is a vessel of receptivity, then that access to whatever we call it, the mystery, the sacred, non-dual presence, love, becomes much more available, much more familiar, much more like a friend that you come to know intimately. And that informs ourselves, our life, how we understand who we are, our place in the scheme of things. So let's just sit quietly for a moment. Let these words sort of percolate. We'll just sit for a few seconds.